when I teach courses on the history of the Black experience, I try to show as much continuity as I do change. And one of the ways that I try to show continuity between the era of slavery and the post-slavery era is talk about the ways in which in America there was slavery, if we could talk about it generally, which or in its essence, slavery was truly about controlling Black bodies, right? Slavery existed to control Black bodies for the sake of profit, for the sake of the super exploitation of Black labor. And so at its core, though, slavery was about controlling Black bodies through violence. Slavery was the ultimate form of racial social control. Lynching emerges post-slavery. Lynching becomes a means to control Black bodies post-slavery. What do I mean by that? Lynching as a form of racial terror. You cannot control every Black person, but you can try to control Black people through terror and terrorism. And so lynching, similar to slavery, becomes a means to control Black bodies. Segregation, more broadly, becomes a means to control Black bodies for what? Right? And slavery is simple. We can say it's simple. It's not. It's about the exploitation of Black people's labor for the sake of profit, for the sake of profit of slaveholders. In the post-emancipation period, why do we control Black bodies, right? We control Black bodies so that we control Black bodies politically, economically, socially, and culturally, right? And that control oftentimes could lead to super exploitation of Black wealth if we're talking about the plantation economy of the South that emerges after slavery. But truly, it was the post-slavery context and lynching as a phenomenon was truly about controlling Black bodies and making Black people what my dear brother Jean Muhammad calls death-bound subjects, people who truly had no place, no belonging in American society.
Dr. Carlos K. Hill is Regents Professor of the Caralupa Department of African and African American Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Dr. Hill is the author of three books, Beyond the Rope, The Impact of Lynching on Black Culture and Memory, The Murder of Emmett Till, A Graphic History, and The 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, A Photographic History. Carlos, thank you so much for taking time for this episode of Realms of Memory.
Thank you for having me.
So I've heard you point out elsewhere that the focus of your book is not really on the lynching victims. It's on the lynched Black body. So what do you mean by that?
So I try to distinguish between actual lynching victims and then representations of lynch victims. And so the lynched Black body are representations of lynching created by cultural workers, whether they're artists, whether they're writers, activists. The lynched Black body as a kind of symbol, right, to try to create meaning around, right? That's right, not actual lynch victims and their stories and how their families dealt with the lynching, right? But the lynched Black body is a construction. It's how we try to make lynching, the history of lynching, do work, to try to serve some sort of political, social, cultural ends. And so when I talk about the lynched Black body, it's about all the things that cultural workers do to give meaning to lynching, to give meaning to the justice movements created to try to prevent or curb lynching. And so the lynched Black body in that contest becomes a contested symbol, right? Within the white supremacist imagination, the lynched Black body is a symbol of Black criminality. Within the Black imagination, what I try to talk about in beyond the rope is the ways in which Black people, Black cultural workers, writers, authors, artists, poets, try to make sense of individual lynching cases, and in doing so, right, create narratives of the lynched Black body to make sense of it. And I talk about victimization narratives of the lynched Black body that Black people created, and consoling narratives of the lynched Black body that Black people created to make sense of the experience of lynching. And so when I talk about the lynched Black body, we're not talking about actual lynch victims. We're talking about representations and how those representations get put to work.
But those representations are significant in that they drive the violence, they drive the reaction to the violence. So it's not an abstraction of the history. I mean, it's really a central part of that story.
Absolutely. And when we think about the history of lynching, representations of the lynched Black body, as you say, is what drove the lynching mania, right? The lynched Black body as a criminal, the lynched Black body as a Black beast rapist, that lynching was the only thing that could potentially quell Black criminality or Black sexual violence against white women. There was this idea that lynching was the form of social control, right? Racial social control that could stymie Black, these assaults on white women. And so lynching was driven by representations, anti-Black representations, mostly of Black men, but certainly the response, right, to lynching and the cultural representations that justified it were all too important. And so African Americans, and what I write about in the book, African Americans confronted the white supremacist lynched Black body by creating versions of it themselves, victimization narratives, right, consoling narratives. And I also talk about the history of Black vigilantism and the ways in which Black people created narratives to make sense of vigilante violence against other Black people. And so it's, for me, I was in the book trying to make sense of all the various ways that Black people made sense of the lynching, not just the ways in which Black people responded to white supremacist narratives of the lynched Black body.
And would you say is it fair to say that they, in terms of representations of the lynched Black body, that Black Americans have been left out of the story? They're the object of the story. They're the victims, but there hasn't been a whole lot of attention that's been given to how they themselves participated in those representations.
Absolutely. I am a Black studies professor and historian. My work is about centering Black people and the Black experience. When we think about the history of lynching and the actors that have driven that history in terms of the historical narratives, it's been the white mob. It's been trying to theorize and understand why white people, honestly, and groups of white people lynched and murdered in public Black people. And because of that, the lynched Black body or lynched victims are often the objects of study, not the subjects of study. And so Beyond the Rope was about really centering Black people, centering Black voices, centering Black memory of lynching in order to understand how that experience evolved over time. Because when we decenter the Black experience, there's this tendency to believe that the experience hasn't changed much. It's been the same. And what I try to show in Beyond the Rope is that our Black people's relationship to lynching has never been the same. It's always been dynamic and evolving. And I try to show that it hasn't just been one of victimization. Black people have also, and this is probably the most controversial aspect of the book, Black people have not simply been victims of lynching. They've also perpetuated vigilante violence in instances. And so how does that help us to understand in a much deeper, richer way the Black experience of lynching. And so these are the deeper questions that I try to get into as I center Black people and the Black experience in the history of lynching, not the lynch mob. And so what you get in my book is a real kind of careful sort of meditation on how Black people responded and then how they made sense of the lynching tree.
Okay. But what I thought was fascinating was that you do zoom out, you give us broader historical perspective, and you note that lynching wasn't racialized until you get to the 1880s. So what was it originally?
Well, when I talk about lynching, I try to be very careful and deliberate. So we can think about lynching in general as a form of social control, right? Social control. Lynching exists to deter, right, unwanted or undesirable social behavior, social political behavior. That is the history of lynching beginning at the turn of the 18th century, right? This is lynching as a kind of form of social control. Right. But when we talk about lynching and the Black experience, beginning in the 20th century, lynching is not just social control. Right. Lynching becomes racial social control. And by racial social control, I mean at the beginning of the 20th century, lynching ceased to be something that targeted lynching ceased to be something that was targeted at social deviants. It became something exclusively targeted at Black people, and namely Black men, right, for related to sexual social deviants connected to white women. And so when we think about how lynching goes from something about social control to, in the 20th century, racial social control, I try to tell the story of how Black people begin to respond to that change through activism, creating the anti-lynching movement, but also the various narratives that were created to try to confront the Black Beast Rapist narrative that we kind of referred to earlier, but also just simply the narrative that it was okay, it was justified to murder Black people in public, right? And lynchings, we can have a lot of different definitions of what lynchings are, right? I've spent my career theorizing about what it is, but put most simply, right, a lynching is the collective murder. It's in the history of the United States, is typically the collective public murder of a Black person, and most specifically a Black male. The public murder, the public killing of a Black person, is what we're talking about when we talk about the history of lynching. And we're talking about the public killing of Black people, of which there was, for 99% of these cases, there was never any form of accountability, not even an investigation, let alone a trial, for those who committed the crime, committed the lynching. And so when we try to understand what happened in America, lynching goes from a phenomenon that primarily targets white people in the 19th century through the 19th century. But by the late 19th century and certainly into the 20th century, this is what the book talks about, lynching becomes something that's targeted at African Americans and particularly African American men exclusively. And that transformation is what I try to talk about, how Black people mobilized, you know, in response to that. And what made this all more complicated is that in the very moment that lynching is becoming racialized, Black people also, because lynching is a form of social control in American society, there's this increasing understanding that participating in lynching, right, as a form of social control, makes one complicit in lynching as a form of racial social control. And so there's this, you know, I try to tease that out, right, and showing how over a period of 20 to 25 years, a generation, you see a steady decline in Black vigilantism. And at the same time, you see a mobilization of an anti-lynching movement. So I use all that to talk about African Americans' changing relationship, right, to lynching and the lynched Black body.
I think you mentioned, too, that there are lynching cases where it's really like a mixed group, mixed white and Black group that are participating in this. So if you think about it originally as a form of social control, what's the violence in response to? What are the typical deviant forms of behavior that they're trying to rein in and control? And how does it change once it becomes racialized?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that I just want to back up so that it's clear that when we talk about the history of lynching in the United States or the history of white on Black lynching, it in no way compares to Black vigilantism. I try to talk about these two phenomenon as not one and the same, but essentially different phenomenon because they spring from different roots. And so hence I don't talk about Black mob violence. I talk about vigilantism, not mob violence. And so, because I don't want people to equate Black vigilantism with white on Black lynching. These two things, although it is at its core vigilantism, regular people taking the law into their own hands, these phenomenon, Black vigilantism, white on Black mob violence, they spring from very different sources, even though they are at the end of the day, vigilante violence. And so I want to just start there. But I would say that when we think about lynching as a form of social control or racial social control, lynchings were always in response to some sort of allegation. When we talk about the Black experience of lynching, we're talking about the two main allegations are rape and murder. Murder accounts for about give or take about 40% of all lynching allegations in total. And the accusation of rape, and these are ballpark figures, accounts for about 20% of all allegations related to white on Black lynching. When we think about the history of white on Black lynching in the United States, right, we can talk about nearly or as in excess of 5,000 victims, documented victims. When we talk about the history of Black vigilantism, we're talking about an order much less. We're talking about, in terms of the Mississippi and Arkansas Delta, we're talking about several hundred instances of Black vigilante violence, not thousands, right? And so these are very different phenomena in terms of their scope and then in terms of their substance, right? When we think about the allegations that led to white on Black vigilantism or white on Black mob violence, again, murder and rape. What made it racialized were the explanations, the ways in which race entered into the allegations or the rationale for the violence. And so when it comes to the Black experience of lynching, it was Black men as uncontrollable sexual beasts, right? That narrative is even though sexual assault only accounted for 20% of all allegations, it was the dominant rationale and certainly the emotional rationale for lynching, right? Sexual assault, the protection of white womanhood discourse was central to its prosecution and to its, and to its defense. White politicians, not just Southern politicians, went onto the floor of Congress defending, right, apologizing for lynching, and needing to have lynching in defense of white womanhood. And so narratives about white racial protection, but also black sexual retrogression became central, the central underpinning narratives of lynching in ways that prior to the late 19th century, prior to the 20th century, when black people are not the exclusive targets of lynching, those rationales are not present, right? And so I try to tell the story of how these narratives of racial, of black sexual retrogression, the black beast rapist narrative, becomes the narrative that justifies lynching. And in doing so, the crimes connected to lynching become racial crimes. And so that's how lynching becomes, it moves from becoming a form of social control to racial social control. And what I try to do is to talk about how black people, black cultural workers, artists, writers, activists mobilize to try to understand the lynched black body outside of the white supremacist imagination and try to understand black people as victims.
Is it fair to say that lynching then had always been about maybe crimes like murder or rape, but then it gets racialized and you get this entire population that becomes associated with that kind of criminality? And there's an assumption that that's just a behavior associated with this community that needs to be there needs to be a surveillance, kind of heightened surveillance, and there's a whole like a propaganda campaign that has to be undertaken to convince a wider public that this community is really a threat, and with that propaganda campaign, then it takes on a whole another magnitude that it never had before. So, but there's a lot of sales work that has to go into convincing the general public that this really is this what unshackled population now is a real threat, and the level of policing needs to be ratcheted up in response to that.
Absolutely. I mean, black people in American society, and certainly in only a generation post-slavery, were still very much seen in that light, right? As objects of white people, not citizens, not individuals who had, or communities that had self-efficacy. And so very much, in the late 19th century, black people are still very much trying to emerge from that slavery, the post-slavery context. And so you're absolutely, absolutely right on that, spot on.
Okay. So you mentioned, so as lynching becomes racialized, you move into the 1880s, it takes on a whole nother magnitude. You have commentators within the African-American community who have to shift their position on lynching. And who are those people? What were their original thoughts and views on the role of and legitimacy of lynching, and then how did they shift course on that?
You know, this is a place in the book where I'm going to be honest, as a writer, I really wish I had done more work and thought more carefully through this. But at the same time, I did come to some really, I think, good reflections on sort of how black people at the turn of the century began to understand this changing context, the ways in which lynching as a kind of a form of social control was increasingly becoming racial social control, targeting black people, namely black men. This happens over a series of years, beginning in the mid to late 1880s, by the 1890s, right, and certainly by the mid-1890s, it's clear, right, that Black people have become the primary targets of lynching. It's during the 1890s, right, and we should say the 1890s is the decade in which this transformation happens, right, where lynching ceases to be something that targets primarily white people to something that primarily targets Black people. It happens in the 1890s. And what we need to understand about the 1890s is that during this decade, right, a Black person in this country is lynched every 3 days. A Black person is lynched every 3 days. That's the equivalent of a George Floyd-like incident happening every 3 days in this country. And that is the lynching era. And so when you think about the 1890s, on average, over 100 Black people were lynched every year. And in 1892, I believe, nearly 160, in fact, more than 160 Black people were lynched in 1892 alone, right? The 1890s is the bloodiest decade for lynching and racial violence. And so African Americans who had existed in a culture where lynching is a form of social control is greeted by the 1890s, where Black people, to the tune of 160 Black people in 1892, but on average 100 every year, are being murdered in public, and there is no public outcry. And so what I would say is that it did not take it. Black people were not proponents of lynching to the point where Black people were creating lynching culture, right? But there was a way in which lynching as a kind of practice was accepted, and in some cases in certain regions of the country, Black America, rural areas like the Mississippi Delta that I talk about, Arkansas, and other rural communities where there was very very little law and order or in fact justices of the peace or just any semblance of kind of legal system, it's in those cases and in those places where we see Black vigilantism. So the point is, even though Black vigilantism occurred, I really want to make sure that people don't make people understand that Black people's attachment to lynching culture was not deep, and that where it did happen, it was often connected to a lack of criminal justice officials and or just an operating legal system in rural counties in the South. And so saying all that, I hope that helps you to understand a bit better this context and what Black people end up responding to.
Okay. So as lynching takes on this whole new magnitude, becomes this epidemic of violence, there's a campaign among African-American commentators to stigmatize what's happening, to create broader awareness of what's going on, to hopefully bring about legislation to respond to this. So what is this campaign? How is it structured? I know the NAACP takes on this anti-lynching campaign and maybe adopts this narrative that others craft before it. What's this new narrative that takes shape within the African American community in response to this surge of violence? What's the campaign that takes shape around that?
And so we've talked about the ways in which during the 1890s, there is an explosion of violence, racist violence, lynching violence against Black people. And that has everything to do with Black communities across the country, petitioning, fighting to maintain political, civil, economic rights across the country, both at the legislative level and at the grassroots level. And so these conflicts, but also just the tensions created by these conflicts is what many scholars, most scholars talk about why lynching, all right, in particular, there's a spike in lynching during the decade of the 1890s, right? The competition or political competition conflict that, you know, or we could talk about it more broadly, Reconstruction, the politics of Reconstruction, right, are playing themselves out in the 1890s. And Black people who are refusing to accept, right, the emergence of segregation, refusing to accept the diminution of political and economic rights, right, or mobilizing, organizing, and those tensions and conflicts are creating the context for which there is an explosion. There is an explosion of racist, racial violence, terror. And so in the wake of a Black person being lynched every 3 days, right, activist organizations emerge, NAACP, but also just activists emerge. Ida B. Wells emerge in, you know, actually, let's talk about Ida B. Wells. She emerges in the 1890s, right? In 1892, the most bloody year for lynching Black people in this country, documented year. It's the same year that Ida B. Wells starts her personal crusade to educate Americans about the blight of lynching. And so at the center of Ida B. Wells' campaign and also going into the future when the NAACP picks up the anti-lynching crusade in the 20th century, they do very much like Ida B. Wells. Ida B. Wells in 1892, beginning in 1892, she writes a pamphlet, Southern Horrors. And across the decade of the 1890s, she writes two other pamphlets. The central goal of those pamphlets is moral suasion, convincing Americans to see Black people as citizens whose rights are being violated in the most brutal way. She wants Americans to bear witness to the brutality that are happening to Black people in the South, right? So she wants to use moral suasion, right? Showing Americans, this is what's happening in your country. This is so inconsistent with your values and beliefs, right? We need to understand these instances as violations of democracy and civilization. And we need to open our hearts to understand this in a different way. She really believed that she could convince Americans through persuasion, through moral suasion, to see lynching differently, and in seeing it differently, mobilize, right, to pass anti-lynching laws to stamp out the phenomenon. And so moral suasion, right, is key, creating a different understanding of the lynched Black body, not one as a criminal, not one as a sexually depraved rapist, but seeing lynch victims as actual victims. And in seeing them as victims, developing a different effective relationship. And so Ida B. Wells and so much of what I think about and do in my career is modeled on someone like Ida B. Wells. What Ida B. Wells was trying to do for white Americans is position them to care about Black people, but let's just say lynch victims in a way that they hadn't before, right? And so what Ida B. Wells did in her activism, let me just say in her pamphlets, is offer a different perspective. So instead of a Black beast rapist, Ida B. Wells in her pamphlets would talk about who Black lynch victims were in life. And she would provide details and context and actually testimonies from people who knew them to dispel this notion, right, that these were criminals and sexually depraved individuals. She showed that individuals often who were lynched were actually upstanding individuals, members of their community, oftentimes respected. She did all this to undermine the Black B beast, rapist discourse that so many white Americans accepted without any critique. She wanted to, through her activism, through bearing witness, show them that there was a deeper narrative, and actually true and authentic narrative, and that if they could come to the realization that this is what's happening, lynchings would come to, so public support for lynchings would come to an end. And so moral suasion was crucial and was the theory of change for Ida B. Wells, as well as the NAACP, who builds upon Ida B. Wells' work in the early 20th century, when they began to use moral suasion, right, to fight for anti-lynching legislation within Congress. And so instead of creating pamphlets to try to persuade white Americans more broadly, the NAACP strategy beginning in 1916, and we can say that strategy, they tried to implement it through to 1950, was to use moral suasion to convince lawmakers to pass anti-lynching legislation to deal with the blight of lynching. And so moral suasion has been key, but it hasn't been, I would say, effective. It wasn't effective in transforming the practice of lynching.
Hmm. Okay. But someone like Ida B. Wells is basically trying to humanize the victims have been dehumanized, right? That's the process that,
yes,
by creating this stigma of the black beast rapist, you dehumanize this population and then you amplify the violence. So you've got to rehumanize those victims by telling their life stories, by framing them as real human beings, right?
You're right.
But I thought when you move on to the NAACP, I thought your point was they actually go into and use the press, the Southern press,
yes,
to really highlight the extreme nature of the violence, and that's part of their marketing strategy to try to it's almost like a shock to shock the general public into awareness by pointing out the extremes of what's going on.
I think it was a 1-2 punch that the NAACP tried to utilize. One was white racial shame, the ways in which white people were failing themselves and the democracy, the ways in which lynching was just so inconsistent with democratic values, these core values. And so there was this belief that, you know, at least within, you know, sort of African American political culture of the time, that these understandings of democracy were potent and they were real, and that white Americans just simply didn't understand how lynching was inconsistent with that. And so they needed to be shown, they needed to be taught, right? Because it wasn't that black people were black beast rapists. It isn't that black people were committing crimes. It was, in fact, that black people were simply protesting or fighting back, and these allegations were being used, right, to cover up, right, black people actually protesting, black people fighting back for their rights. And so Ida B. Wells believed if the true thing, the true nature of things was known, then it would change white behavior. If the true nature was known. But what becomes really clear to people like Ida B. Wells, W.E.B. Du Bois, and other black activists is that lynching was truly a cultural mania that made no real sense, right, in terms of its practice, right? Black people were lynched not because they were true threats, but just because a white person perceived them to be a threat. Black people were lynched for anything and everything in the South. And perhaps the best example of that is my dear brother Emmett Till, who's lynched for whistling at a white woman in 1955 in Money, Mississippi. This is lynching culture. There is no sense for why Black people are lynched. Black people are lynched because and only because they are perceived to be threats to white people and or white supremacy. And so lynching culture, when historians like me and Black studies professors like me try to make sense of it and make it all line up, it doesn't. It's an irrational phenomenon. The ways in which it was rationalized, the ways in which it was justified, hell, the ways in which it was even practiced. Irrational. I try to be careful not to try to make it all make sense because it doesn't. We haven't talked about the ways in which the grisly, grotesque nature of lynch mob violence. Historians don't like to talk about that because it is the bone chilling nature, the sadistic nature of the violence. Goes so far beyond the allegations that individuals were accused of that we understand that this is much more at stake than just law and order with lynching. There's much more at stake, and some of that at stake still for this Black studies historian. I'm trying to make sense of it. The levels of the grotesque and sadistic violence.
Yeah, could you comment on that? Because that is shocking when you, especially when it's made into a public event, right? And people are taking pictures alongside of what's happening and really taking souvenirs. It's almost like going to a baseball game.
Yes, and that's what we have to really. This is the part of lynching culture that we have to grapple with today. Lynching culture didn't die with lynching as a phenomenon. Lynching culture lived on. What lynching culture is at its root is an indifference to Black people and Black humanity. You said it earlier. Activists had to humanize lynch victims, right? Lynching was about dehumanizing Black people, but ultimately it was about being indifferent to Black suffering, right? And so lynching and racial violence and how it shows up today is indifference to Black people and Black suffering. That hasn't gone anywhere. And so when I try to talk about the history of lynching, it's always lynching culture and the ways in which lynching culture persists in the form of mass incarceration, in the form of police killings, shootings, beatings of Black people, men, women, and child. That's how lynching culture shows up today. That's how the history of slavery shows up today. And unless we are attentive to it, it's as if those things don't exist or never existed.
So you make this point, right, that there is no one representation of lynched Black body, that this is something that you get a population that gets dehumanized in response to reaction to Reconstruction and gets stigmatized and that drives the violence. And then you get a response and new efforts to humanize this same population to sensitize the public to what's happening. And then you mentioned as you move further in time that there's this consoling narrative that takes shape, this effort to try to sensitize the public by humanizing the victims doesn't do a whole lot for African Americans themselves. The people who are living through the trauma of this experience, they need to understand it in a different way to cope with the reality of it. What is this consoling narrative? How does that work?
I just want to back up. I want us to understand why I'm so focused on narrative and why narrative is so important. I created a book rooted in narrative theory, right? And this understanding that narratives and cultural narratives are crucial for memory and how communities remember the past. And so for me, what was really, really important in trying to capture the Black experience of lynching and what and how lynching try to capture the dynamism of lynching and its history, it was really important for me to not just capture what African Americans said about lynching at different points, but the ways in which African Americans utilize lynching and the lynched Black body, representations of the lynched Black body, in order to create a usable past. A usable past, right? The usable past is about how history can be used in the service of something greater. And in the context of the anti-lynching movement, the history of lynching, the lynched Black body as a usable past had to be about humanizing Black people because of what I talked about, that period of the 1890s. And so the victimization narratives of the lynched Black body was a kind of a usable past that could be put in service of really changing the conversation about who lynch victims were and why they were deserving of sympathy and one support. And so that was a usable past, right, in the service of justice. When we talk about consoling narratives of the lynch Black body, we're talking about a usable past, but it's really in the service of memory and how Black people utilize that memory to galvanize community, to galvanize activism, right? And so when I talk about consoling narratives, these aren't narratives utilized to actually, as the NAACP utilized, you know, in Congress, right? The consoling narratives were not of use there, right? They had a different purpose, a different tone and tenor even, right? They weren't simply about seeing Black people as actual victims worthy of sympathy and support. Consoling narratives were truly about understanding not what happened to Black people, but what Black people did in response to what happened to them at the lynching tree, or in terms of the lynching news, right? And so because the emphasis in consoling narratives is on how Black people responded to what happened to them, we have to talk about agency. We have to talk about the ways in which Black people fought back, the ways in which Black people mobilized and organized. And in doing so, we can see that in the history of lynching, although Black people were victims and should be understood as victims, they weren't exclusively victims, that there's a history of agency. There's a history of resilience and resistance that was useful for the community to understand and to make sense of. And so I try to tease out, right? In the book, what I call the felt history of Black memory of lynching, right? What made Black people really proud when they talked about lynching, fighting back, resisting? That those are the memories that when recalled, Black people spoke about in with great pride. And those stories were in so many ways central to I would argue pushing for resistance into the future. There's also memories of Black people, there's also memories of lynching that recall the terror, that recall the brutality. This is also a part of the felt history. These are the things that made the Black community or those who experienced lynching deeply saddened, deeply troubled. And so in all those ways, I tried to share a history of lynching that you typically would not get when you're focused on the mob and when you're focused on mobs of when you're focused on mobs of narratives of mob violence, when you start to focus on how Black people turn lynching into a usable past, these are the kinds of stories that emerge.
Okay, I want to respect your time constraint, but can I ask you one Oklahoma question? Because what makes this so fascinating for me is not just the work you're doing, but where you're doing it. To me, you're at ground zero of a lot of the history wars that are happening. And, you know, and I look at what's happening in Oklahoma with this 1775 bill that kind of handcuffs what teachers can do in the classroom. And at the same time, really progressive things that are happening in places like Tulsa. Is Oklahoma just does it represent these cross currents of things that are happening in the U.S.?
I think you are spot on to say that. I truly believe Oklahoma is a kind of ground zero for a lot of things happening in our country, whether it's related to DEI, whether it's related to sort of the wave of legislation around curbing the teaching of slavery. Oklahoma, in one way or another, is where that stuff begins or where that stuff ultimately comes. And so I think you're right that Oklahoma is kind of a nexus. I've certainly experienced that in terms of historical remembrance. I often say to people when I'm in Germany or when I'm traveling around the U.S. that Greenwood or Tulsa is the most important remembrance culture connected to racial violence in the country. And I say that for so many reasons, because of the attention that has been on Tulsa over the last six to eight years in the lead up to the 100th anniversary of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. On that day, on the 100 years after that happened, you had the President of the United States in Tulsa talking about why that history was so important. Not only you have the President of the United States, you have some active initiatives to deal with how the history of the massacre is showing up today. So there's a committee today tasked with finding the graves of Black people who were killed for no fault of their own, bodies thrown into mass graves and never receiving any kind of justice. We're still dealing with that history in some very concrete ways. And for all those reasons, I say Tulsa, Oklahoma in general, is ground zero, epicenter for a lot of the things that we're talking about. Let me just say also that, you know, my work in Tulsa and in anywhere there's a remembrance community is always about trying to be in service to the community, to the community centered histories, and trying to truly be in service to the history through creating community-centered histories. That has been my calling card. That's been where I found my passion. That's where I found my greatest sort of passion for serving, is really walking alongside communities and telling community-centered histories. For me, centered on victims, survivors, and descendants of racial violence.
Carlos K. Hill is Regents Professor of the Clara Luper Department of African and African American Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I've been talking with him today about his book, Beyond the Rope, The Impact of Lynching on Black Culture and Memory. He is also the author of The Murder of Emmett Till, A Graphic History, and The 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, A Photographic History. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend and review us on your favorite podcast app. I'm Rick Dedarian. See you soon.